All right, thanks everyone. You can be seated, please. All right, now we're going to hear the Scott Gessler versus Colorado Common Cause and Colorado Ethics Watch case. May I have any of your appearances, please?
Matthew Grove, Your Honor, on behalf of the Colorado Secretary of State,
All right, thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Jennifer Hunt from Robbins, appearing on behalf of Colorado Common Cause. Maybe Council Stuhl is Ms. Tara Carroll, representing Colorado Ethics Watch.
Very good. This case is set for an hour. It means each side will have 30 minutes. Council, you are responsible for keeping track of your own time. Mr. Grove, ready whenever you are, sir.
May it please the court? I'm here on behalf of the Colorado Secretary of State. This case is about administrative rulemaking in the First Amendment context, but the substantive First Amendment questions in front of this court are packaged in a very unusual way. In fact, this case doesn't really require the court to directly address the First Amendment and what it means in the First Amendment, in the campaign finance context at all. Rather, we're here to discuss whether the Secretary has appropriately interpreted what the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals has said about the First Amendment in the issue committee context. Now, reasonable minds can certainly differ as to whether Sampson versus Buescher was correctly decided in the Tenth Circuit. But whether that court got the ruling objectively correct isn't the operative question here, because Sampson would bind the Secretary even if this court, as it would be free to do, were to disagree with the case's reasoning or outcome. So I'm not here to re-argue the merits of Sampson today. I'm here to discuss the effect that the Tenth Circuit's ruling had on Colorado law and what it says about the future enforceability of the constitutional and statutory regulations that apply to issue committees of every size. So the first question is, what was the scope of the Sampson ruling?
You even get to the scope, could I just ask you to, you started off presuming that we would be bound by the Tenth Circuit. Would you kind of flesh that out and explain why you think that is?
This court isn't bound by the Tenth Circuit. I don't think there's any question about that. But the Secretary is bound by the Tenth Circuit.
And explain why that is.
The Secretary was a party to the Sampson case. Secretary Buescher was the named defendant in that case. It was a challenge to the laws that the Secretary of State is obligated to administer and enforce, and which he has rulemaking authority to administer and enforce. And so, to the extent that the Sampson versus Buescher case has precedential authority, and I know that that's an issue of contention in this case, the scope of the decision, the Secretary...
Well, also just a question of the precedential value of a Tenth Circuit opinion. Is that an issue?
Not... The question whether the Tenth Circuit's opinion has precedential value, I don't think, is an issue. It does. The real question is...
I thought you just said it didn't bind this court. Who does it have precedential value for?
It does for parties to the Sampson case.
With regard to the issues in the Sampson case, or anything having to do with those parties?
Well, with regard to the issues that were addressed in the Sampson case. So the question is, I think, whether an as-applied challenge, as it was framed and decided by the Tenth Circuit, has precedential value for other cases that arise in a similar context, and what that similar context may be. And this court, I think, one of the things that is incumbent on this court is to decide what an appropriate similar context to the Sampson case may be.
Could I ask you one other question? I didn't pick up anything about an injunction here. Did I miss that? Were we enjoined in any way? Were you enjoined in any way?
The Secretary was enjoined. The
Secretary was enjoined.
Yes, from the last line of the opinion. It's not the last line of the opinion. The opinion says that the Secretary cannot enforce the issue committee regulations against the Sampson committee. That much is very specific. The question then is, building on what else the opinion says about who can be regulated the situations under which issue committees can be regulated, how that applies to the remainder of issue committees.
I think just one last, to make sure I understand that, because that last point was where I was trying to go. So clearly, the judgment in that course, in that case, bound the parties in that case. And the judgment I'm hearing you say, and as I understood it to be, was that the secretary couldn't enforce against the parties in that case, except to the extent that the Tenth Circuit said with regard to the values. But this was not a declaratory judgment or something in that nature to be followed or concurrent with an injunction to prevent the secretary from enforcing this provision of the statute.
The Sanford plaintiffs brought both a facial and an as-applied challenge. And the district court addressed only the as-applied challenge. It did it in a very narrow way. It held that it exercised constitutional avoidance, and it did its very best to avoid ruling any more broadly than it had to. The Tenth Circuit took a completely different approach. It did not address the facial challenge. I will grant you that. But what it did do was utilize reasoning. It completely diverged from the federal district court's reasoning and issued a ruling that simply couldn't be reconciled with enforcement of issue committee registration and disclosure requirements against any small issue committee in any context.
I don't mean to dominate your time, but you keep leading me on to one last question all the time here. So let me, just as a boundary concept here then, given the way you phrased that last response, let's assume the Tenth Circuit had said, this statute is facially unconstitutional. Now, you're saying that wouldn't bind us. Would that, in what way would that bind the Secretary of State with regard to cases other than the one that was pending before the Tenth Circuit?
If the Tenth Circuit had ruled the issue committee registration requirement, it's an Amendment 27, to be facially unconstitutional, well, there are two things. That would have meant that no issue committees under any circumstance would be required to register and report in this state. It wouldn't bind this court. This court would be free to disagree with that. But the Secretary, under pain of loss of qualified immunity under Section 1983, would not be in a position to enforce any provisions of the statute. It would still be on the books. This court could presumably issue an opinion that came up through the Office of Administrative Courts if there was some sort of challenge and say, we disagree with Sampson. That would be not an exceptional outcome given the treatment that Sampson has gotten from other courts. But that doesn't change the fact that it binds the Secretary, and the Secretary, as required by qualified immunity statute, Section 1983, would have to continue to comply with the Tenth Circuit's rule.
Thank you.
Well, but here we got the situation where the Tenth Circuit was very clear there wasn't drawing a line. The Secretary takes on rulemaking authority and draws a line. As far as I can see, there's nothing in the Tenth Circuit decision that enjoined or required the Secretary to do anything. Is that right?
There's a difference between declining to draw a specific line, Justice Hobbs, and saying that a specific line exists, but not taking the next step and drawing. That's what the Tenth Circuit did. The Tenth Circuit said, there is a line, and then it backed away and said, but we're a court, and it's not our position. We're not an administrator, we're not a legislature, we're not the people who passed Amendment 27. It's not our job, and it would be going too far to say where the line is.
The opinion is very carefully crafted to talk about this neighborhood dispute in a small town regarding an annexation matter. It seems to distinguish that between other kinds of applications of these are constitutional requirements, are they not? And
they're in Amendment 27, yes.
Right. So what do you say about the pains that the Tenth Circuit took to try to localize this dispute, and now we have a statewide rule that puts a line, I don't know what the line's justified on, but twice what these folks paid that the Tenth Circuit said didn't, you know, what they had to pay because of this didn't justify their denial of their right to assembly and petition. Let's put it that way.
I think what you have to look at is the situation that Secretary Buschert faced when he decided to institute the rulemaking proceeding. So first you've got the federal district court opinion, and I think it's very useful if you haven't looked back at the two to compare the federal district court opinion with the Tenth Circuit opinion and how those two courts approach the issue. The federal district court opinion, I would agree, is it's focused like a laser on what happened. The way that the Sampson versus Pusher case got to the federal district court in the first place was, well, it wasn't a high watermark for the integrity of the private enforcement system that Amendment 27 put in place. To be frank, and the federal district court said this in very candid terms, the administrative enforcement system was abused in a manner that was designed to squelch opponents of this annexation measure, prevent them from speaking. The federal district court focused very closely on that and said that, okay, in an annexation situation where the private enforcement system is abused in this way, First Amendment rights of these issue committee folks, the opponents of the annexation measure, their rights were violated because of the specific circumstances that apply. Mm-hmm. The Tenth Circuit took a very different approach. Yes, I agree that they did outline, the Tenth Circuit did outline the facts of what happened below, how they got there, all of those things. But if you look at the whole of the opinion and the reasoning that the court used to get there, it's very different than the approach that the federal district court took. At page 1249, this is in the introduction of the Sampson Tenth Circuit opinion. Just at the end of the introduction, the court says, we address the plaintiff's as-applied challenge here, and then the next sentence says, this is a quote, there is virtually no proper governmental interest in imposing requirements on ballot initiative committees, plural, that raise so little money, and that limited interest cannot justify the burden that those requirements impose on such a committee. So the Tenth Circuit wasn't directly addressing, it wasn't considering the fact that the private enforcement process was abused, that these particular ballot initiative opponents were prevented from speaking because of fear that they would be subpoenaed, that they would be subject to that they would be subject to attorney fees, that they would have to sign this document created by the person who complained against them called stipulation and guilty plea. Those were all the sort of outrageous abuses that occurred. Instead, the Tenth Circuit looked at solely how much does this cost? What is the administrative burden on an issue committee that raises small amounts of money? And on the other side of the ledger, what is the public interest? Do people actually care? Are people going to look and say, well, these folks raised $2,000 and over half of that went to attorney fees, and is that going to influence the way that people vote? And the Tenth Circuit said very clearly that the answer is no. Now, the really interesting thing about this is that the case and the election that was underlying the Sampson litigation was tiny. It was infinitesimally small. 372 votes were cast. There were a total of $2,200 raised and spent. As I said, about half of that went to attorney fees. About, I think, $900 of it was before the administrative complaint was filed. And in an election with 372 votes cast, that's $5 per voter that was actually spent by the committee. And even if you leave the attorney fees out, that's $2 per voter when you consider just the amount that was spent on the express advocacy portion. If you extrapolate that out to a statewide election, you're talking about millions of dollars that the Tenth Circuit, assuming that it would apply the same reasoning, would require to be the threshold to be constitutionally accepted as a compelled disclosure under the First Amendment. So we didn't draw the line at millions of dollars, although frankly I think it would be justified in the Tenth Circuit's opinion. What the Secretary of State did was it first decide that based on the language that I just quoted from the Tenth Circuit's opinion, that the $200 threshold could not be enforced because the Tenth Circuit said it couldn't. And if it couldn't be enforced in a tiny election, it certainly couldn't be enforced in a much bigger election, which almost every other election would be. And then he took on rulemaking proceedings, took evidence, did an analysis, and decided that $5,000 was the point at which the administrative burden associated with putting together, registering as an issue committee, getting a bank account, appointing a registered agent, tracking donations, tracking expenditures to the extent that are required by amendment 27, at that point, that the scale started to balance out under the 10th Circuit's analysis, and that the public interest in disclosure and larger amounts of donations coming in were better balanced with the administrative burden that those imposed.
Council, could I pick up right there? Because I struggled to find the justification for the second part of the rule, which exempts any committee from compliance period up until the point they provided that $1,000 figure. What in the Sampson decision drives that piece of the rule?
Well, there are really two pieces of the answer. So let me give you the simple one first. The first question is whether compulsory disclosure up to the threshold, whatever that disclosure may be required by, is actually compelled by something in the Constitution or the statute. The relevant statute that the plaintiffs identify is section 145.8. And that statute says, and I'm just saying this off the top of my head, so don't quote me on it, says essentially that an issue committee must report all expenditures and contributions. And so the real question is, what is an entity that spends money before it reaches issue committee status? And so the secretary's position on the first part of this is that the rule doesn't conflict with the statute or the Constitution, because there is no regulation required for an entity that spends less than whatever the threshold amount may be. The second answer to the question is that what the Sampson court was concerned about was not so much the fact that public disclosures had to be made, not so much the fact that people might find out about who was supporting the initiative or who was opposing it, how much they might spend. Rather, the administrative burden was the primary issue that they were concerned with. And if you were going to have to report the first $5,000 anyway, once you get past it, you as an issue committee are going to have to do virtually all of the same things that you would have to do otherwise. And so you would have to track who was contributing to your cause. You'd have to, if they contributed more than $20, get their address. If they contributed more than $100, get their occupation, an employer. And you have to put all of these things in. And at some point, yes, you would have to go, once you reach the $5,000 threshold, you would have to go into the secretary's website and publicly register and disclose those things. But the administrative burden really wouldn't change much between those two categories. Now, if you exempt the first $5,000 or the first $200, whatever the figure may be, from that calculus, then you do have to take sort of general bookkeeping principles into account. You would have to say, okay, I got $50 in a donation today, and you can do it on a piece of paper and say, okay, I spent $100 on stamps, and once one of those reaches $5,000, then at that point you can start to disclose. But the level of detail that's required and the administrative burden that's associated with that are substantially different, and I think more consistent with the Sampson Court's approach. When you exempt the first $5,000, or again, whatever that figure may be, from disclosure entirely.
So how does that in fact work? If a committee, kind of, I'm thinking both sides of the line, just a little bit under, maybe just a little bit over. If a committee isn't quite sure it's going to hit that $5,000 threshold, you're saying you still are going to have to track expenditures and contributions in case you do, and too bad for you, sorry, if you end up maxing out at $49.50 or something like that, at least you didn't have to actually formally file the reports?
You have to track in a general way, but you don't have to track with the same level of detail that Amendment 27 and the Fair Campaign Practices Act would otherwise require.
Okay, and if I do get to 5,010, am I only reporting the 10, or do I have to go back now and report all 5,010?
And that's the entire point. No, okay. You would only report the 10, the $10 that put you over.
So the first 5,000 goes completely undisclosed, doesn't need to be reported at any point.
Except to the extent that by virtue of registering with the Secretary of State to indicate that you have formed an issue committee, that you've reached the threshold, then yes, there's no disclosure of who contributed that first $5,000 or who you spent. What you spent the first $5,000 on.
Thank you.
The Secretary of State really had three choices after the Sampson ruling came out. He could have A, ignored it. That's what the plaintiffs and the Court of Appeals thought should have happened. And in that case, simply required issue committees to either file offensive litigation to determine whether they too should be subject to regulation. And that's happened, as this court is aware, in the Coalition for Secular Government case. That's exactly what happened afterwards. Or they could be subject to defensive litigation. They go ahead, create an issue committee, don't create an issue committee, spend money, and just hope that they don't get a campaign finance complaint from the surrogates. That would have been one option. That is an option that has been sharply disfavored by the U.S. Supreme Court, both in Wisconsin Right to Life and Citizens United. Rulemaking by adjudication, asking the court for permission to speak, is frowned on in the First Amendment context. Another option would have been for the Secretary of State to throw up his hands and say, well, the one line that the Sampson Court gave us was that this case is very different than ones in which tens of millions of dollars are spent on issue committee regulation. And the Secretary could have simply said, well, we really never had a ballot initiative in this case in which tens of millions of dollars have been spent. At most, we have certainly gotten some millions, but we're not California in terms of how much money is spent on our cases, you know, in our ballot initiatives. And basically said, okay, we don't have any more disclosure requirements. I think that based on the language of Sampson, that probably would have been a defensible position. What the Secretary decided to do was to take the middle ground approach and to provide the sort of clarity that the Tenth Circuit refused to give. And that clarity was based on the administrative record that showed that reviewing the 70 or so issue committees that had been established in the previous cycle, that there was this pretty sharp gradient between about $5,000 and then committees that are more focused on broader statewide issues. And so you've got issue committees that are focused on local issues, Save Our Shelters, water districts, things like that, annexations. They usually tend to cluster on the lower end of the scale. And then you've got issue committees, you know, Amendment 64, marijuana, major water rights issues, other things like that. Those committees tend to collect and spend tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. What you don't have, based on the administrative record, is a whole lot of committees that fall in this, say, $5,000 to $15,000 range. Sure, there are a few, but if you do analysis, they're fairly few and far between. So that was the basis for where the Secretary decided to draw the line at $5,000. The record supports that. There's substantial evidence in the record.
Now, the problem is that it looks like it's a use of legislative authority, which, of course, is what rulemaking is. The General Assembly didn't bite this off. And it erodes a number that's in the Constitution of the state of Colorado. So what is the source of the Secretary's rulemaking authority to accomplish this?
The Secretary is obligated under Amendment 27, it's in Section 9, to administer and enforce Colorado's campaign finance laws. A reasonable reading of Sampson demonstrates that the $200 threshold is not administratable or enforceable in any context based on the language in the opinion. It would have been great. The cleanest option clearly would have been ballot initiative for somebody to come and turn this into whatever number wanted to be proposed by ballot initiative. $1,000 might have been reasonable, $10,000 might have been reasonable. It's been 3 years since the Tenth Circuit opinion came out, it's been 5 years since the Federal District Court opinion came out, and there hasn't been any movement on that front. Legislation would have been another option, and in fact, Secretary Bush suspended the rulemaking procedures because it looked like initially there was going to be a legislative fix. Whether the legislature has more authority to do this than the Secretary, given the language that obligates the Secretary to administer and enforce the campaign finance rules, is a separate question. But the bottom line is that the proposed legislation never got off the ground, and it has not in the 3 years following that. And so it's not ideal, but it's also not unique. The Secretary has had a number of opportunities, a number of times in the wake of Amendment 27, not only that, but before Amendment 27 was passed, in which federal courts and sometimes state courts have cast doubt on the constitutionality of particular provisions in Colorado's campaign finance law. The most prominent example of that came after the Colorado Rights of Life Committee decision from the 10th Circuit, in which the court cast serious doubt on the definition of issue committee, which set forth two criteria. It said an issue committee is created either if under one of two circumstances: if you reach a spending threshold of $200, or if you have a major purpose of advocating for or against a particular ballot measure. The secretary, by rule, the rules have been renumbered, I can't remember which one it is, I think it's 1.12, changed that or, the disjunctive, to an and. Now, did he have authority to do that explicitly under section 9.2 of amendment 27? I'm not clear on that. I mean, it's the same situation as we have here. As a provision of amendment 27 is declared unenforceable, whether explicitly or as applied or official challenge, the secretary had to take action to ensure that the campaign finance system as a whole continued to be enforceable in some sense.
But no one could challenge that particular rulemaking.
It has never been explicitly challenged, no, but it has been noted probably in half a dozen cases since then. I think it wasn't challenged because there wasn't any question as to the unconstitutionality, how it would, that the issue committee definition of Amendment 27 was unconstitutional, as declared by the 10th Circuit. I think it's the same situation we have here.
Counsel, can I just follow up, though? I think I heard you say in this instance, the secretary stepped forward because the legislature did not, and the initiative did not. There was no other initiative. But I'm wondering, what's your position, and maybe you already said this, but could the legislature come forward with a different law? Or could we pass on an initiative, a different threshold?
Certainly, and I think that if either of those happened, they would supersede what the secretary has done here.
Okay.
Absolutely, there's no question with respect to a new ballot initiative, what that would do.
Okay, thank you.
If I could reserve the remainder of my time for a vote.
You may.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Good morning. It appears that both sides do agree on a key point, that the 10th Circuit in Sampson did hold that Colorado's registration and reporting requirements for issue committees cannot be enforced in situations factually similar to the Sampson plaintiffs. We agree on that much. So the question is then whether the secretary has the authority to raise the threshold of regulation for all issue committees in an attempt to address the limited application of the Sampson rule. This court does not need to, and I believe counsel acknowledges, does not need to and should not address the question of whether Article 28 and other applications violates the First Amendment, or whether there is a bright line rule that should be drawn somewhere other than $200. The question is not what the secretary could have or should have done. The question is whether what he did is a valid exercise of his authority. Our position in the ruling of both the trial court and the Court of Appeals is that the secretary cannot take a limited, as-applied judicial ruling, apply a broader interpretation to it, and then use rulemaking to rewrite constitutional and statutory provisions that have not been declared unconstitutional. So, to get right to the key question, the question is whether the Sampson decision can be interpreted reasonably, so broadly, as to apply as a support rule that contradicts Article 28, Section 210A, and the Fair Campaign Practices Act disclosure provisions. The answer, I submit, is going to be no. And how do we know this? The Sampson opinion tells us. In several places, the opinion makes clear that the court is not issuing a facial ruling on the constitutionality of this threshold. At 1249 in the opinion, quote, we agree that Colorado law, as applied to plaintiffs, has violated their constitutional freedom of association. At page 1254, they note that because they agree with the plaintiffs' as applied First Amendment argument, they're not going to address the other contentions. And other contentions included a facial challenge seeking a declaratory judgment that the reporting provision or the threshold was unconstitutional. And at 12:59, they again say that they were going to waive interest the government had against the First Amendment right of association in the context of this case. And then finally, they hold at 12:61 that it was unconstitutional to impose the burden on plaintiffs. And they say, we do not attempt to draw a bright line rule that the ballot issue committee cannot be required to report contributions and expenditures. We say only that plaintiffs' contributions and expenditures were below the line. And I think it's worth noting that at least one other circuit subsequently has noted that the Sampson was an as-applied ruling that did not invalidate the entire provision.
Could I just have you pick up on that very last case of the opinion that you mm-hmm. quoted about we're not going to set a line, but clearly these contributions of roughly $2,000 fall well below that line. What is the secretary, as a party who is bound by that ruling and responsible for enforcing these provisions, supposed to do with that language? It seems to suggest that the $200, I mean, clearly these contributions and expenditures in this case were 10 times above the explicit $200 threshold. And the Tenth Circuit has suggested there's some line up there somewhere. What is the secretary supposed to do with that language, in your opinion?
Right. I think we all acknowledge that the secretary is in a somewhat difficult position that the Tenth Circuit left him in by refusing to draw a bright line rule. But that is what the Tenth Circuit did and made very clear that they weren't prepared to draw that line. Now, I think the question becomes, what is similarly situated? Because that's when we get to an as-applied ruling and the effect of that, you look at what other parties would be similarly situated. And I think that you have to look at the particular factual context of the case that the Tenth Circuit was addressing. Similarly situated does not just mean the amount of money the committee spends. The court looked at the relationship between the threshold and the amount at issue and the nature of the issue involved. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach.
So you would read that language, or you would suggest that the secretary should read that language to say it's not cutting out the $200 threshold and pulling it out of the provision altogether. Rather, this is simply for the circumstances that arose in the Parker North case, that threshold didn't work and couldn't be applied to those folks.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's how you look at that.
Are you taking the position that you could enforce the $200 limit in a similar, I mean, where would $200 apply? You couldn't apply it here.
I think you can look at the example, say, of a statewide ballot initiative. Say there was a fracking initiative, to be topical. So there was an initiative there and a committee was still in the beginning stages and was forming up. I think that there's no question that the $200 reporting threshold would apply to a committee like that. I think that the Tenth Circuit was pretty explicit that there are other applications of this threshold that would be constitutional.
You would say that you could apply $200 in a larger issue that is statewide, but you couldn't apply it in a local issue, which they couldn't even have a line of 2,000? Help me with that.
I think it's a case-by-case analysis, and I think it is difficult. The Tenth Circuit did not provide very much guidance on where they were going with this. I think it's also...
So your argument is that it should be left to case-by-case adjudication, how much you could spend.
Yes, in the absence of legislative action or another ballot initiative. I mean, there are other options for addressing this ambiguity.
Okay, but those two have not acted. So in the absence, it's you enforce the $200 and then it's a case-by-case adjudication.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Could I you've made quite a point of emphasizing, as did the Court of Appeals, that this was a limited as applied holding. And for that reason, the Secretary of State can't pass a rule. Are you suggesting that the Secretary of State could have passed a rule if the Tenth Circuit had said this provision is flatly a violation of the Supremacy Clause and unconstitutional?
That's a good question. And I think this goes back to your question earlier about whether the 10th Circuit law is binding on the Secretary of State. I think there is some questions to whether that's controlling law for the Secretary of State. I'll note that that the weight of the authority in other circuits goes the opposite direction of the Sampson holding. The Supreme Court hasn't directly addressed this question, but there are, in fact, subsequent to Sampson, there are a number of cases, I think they're actually cited in footnote 5 of the Secretary's opening brief, that discuss the criticisms of the Sampson ruling, and Sampson is clearly an outlier. But I think that if there was a facial ruling, the question would be closer, but I'm not sure.
Would it be closer that the Secretary could pass a rule?
Potentially, but again...
What would it have to pass a rule on if the provision were held unconstitutional?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand.
If its job is to enforce the finance, the election finance laws, and the law in this case, imposing limits, were held to be flatly unconstitutional, what could it pass a rule on? Are you saying it could, in effect, legislate a new finance limitation?
Oh, no, I think finance? I misunderstood your question. I'm sorry. I think that if the law was currently unconstitutional, it would likely be up to the legislature to perform its legislative functions to do that.
And so does that amount, I guess where I'm going is, so is your argument, although we're talking a lot about this being a limited as applied ruling, is your argument in effect the Secretary just can't pass a rule dealing with this?
Secretary can't pass a rule that is contrary to the Colorado Constitution and the Colorado statutes that he is supposed to be upholding and enforcing.
He couldn't pass a rule to replace a statute or constitutional provision that was actually held unconstitutional, is that right?
I think that's probably right, but that's not what happened here.
Well, you're really arguing for enforcement discretion, right? And the 10th Circuit kind of said, pick your case very carefully. I'm just wondering, you want this law enforced, but you recognize that you're bound by this local citizen effort to try to protect their First Amendment petition rights and so on and so forth. So which one do you want? Selective enforcement or some kind of enforceable guidelines that give... that implement the spirit of what the 10th Circuit was after?
Well, I think that the statute, the provision should be enforced as it is written in the Constitution. I think that if there were enforcement actions brought against a particular group, and they could certainly raise this as a defense and say they are not an issue committee, but we would all love a bright line rule from the 10th Circuit of some sort. They weren't willing to do that. I think that potentially if there were further litigation, you might get more guidance out of the 10th Circuit or maybe out of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Or out of our court.
That issue is not before you today, though, Your Honors. Respectfully, the issue today is whether what the Secretary actually did was within the authority based on the impact of an as-applied ruling and his ruling the authority as Secretary of State.
In terms of thinking about, okay, let's say we agree with you and the $200 stays in and the Secretary should march on and continue to enforce the $200 threshold, irrespective of the ruling in Sampson. How does, sort of two pieces, how does he give clear guidance to issue committees coming to the office saying, do I need to report or not report? And how... Well, let's start with that question. How does he offer clear guidance?
But, well, I do think that the Secretary could do more to streamline the reporting process. I don't know if the Secretary can, again, because the 10th Circuit cannot provide a bright line answer to the question, and that, again, is the problem with the Sampson ruling. I know that the General Assembly, of course, already has done made some changes, as is their jurisdiction to do, to ameliorate some of the concerns that were raised by the Sampson plaintiffs and were of concern during that case. For example, the statute was amended to clarify that when a municipal annexation question becomes a ballot issue, there's also now they have to notify proponents of a ballot issue at the time the petition is approved that they have to register as an issue committee. So there are things like that that have already happened.
But I guess on the back half of my question is, if I am part of the issue committee, or I think the group that is forming might become an issue committee, and I'm not sure if I'm going to have to comply or not, and if I don't comply, I'm left with kind of a tough situation for those groups, because either I go ahead and report, even if I think it's unconstitutional as applied to my little tiny group, because I'm only spending $1,500, or I go forth and I don't report, but I run the risk of then find myself having to defend a complaint. And doesn't that situation, that ambiguity itself, chills free speech? Is that not a First Amendment concern unto itself?
I think that what the secretary should be doing is advising on the current state of the law. And I think that committees should report. If a committee really believes strongly, the person believes strongly that they shouldn't have to, of course, it's within their rights to file a case saying that they shouldn't have to, but I think that the secretary, as far as what he should be doing, is advising groups that they need to comply with the reporting statute. Thank you.
Can I ask one question? The attorney suggested that the secretary might actually be subjecting himself to a burden in the federal courts if he were to go ahead and enforce this law at all, at least in anything that might be considered similar to the situation that occurred in the case in Sampson. Could you comment on that?
I think that goes back to whether the law is clearly established. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a whole line of cases in other circuits, other federal circuits, that go against the Sampson ruling. So I'm not sure that Secretary would be subject to 1983 action as this being clearly established law and violating that. I think that has not been determined yet. And in any event, the Secretary is charged with upholding these laws, and sometimes part of that job is he may end up in a lawsuit, but that goes with the territory.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, you're saying that other circuits have disagreed with the Sampson ruling on the merits?
Yes. On the disclosure, on the question of the burdens of disclosure versus the state's interest in having the information out there for voters on who is supporting or opposing ballot questions.
So you're saying those other circuits make the law that the 10th Circuit issued with regard to this particular secretary unclear?
I think potentially, because it's really the U.S. Supreme Court that is the final arbiter of course, the First Amendment questions. And so there's clearly at least a split of the circuits, and I think more than that, the 10th Circuit is really an outlier in this area.
Okay, thank you.
I do want to spend a couple minutes on the what I've referred to as the loophole in the rule, just as Mark has mentioned earlier. And I submit that the any notion that this rule is intended simply to apply the Sampson ruling is belied by paragraph A of that rule that allows and exempts the first $4,999 of contributions and expenditures from any disclosure. It is blatant overreaching. It's a clear violation of the FCPA, which requires issue committees to report all contributions, the names and addresses of contributors who contribute $20 or more in all expenditures. There's nothing in the Sampson ruling to support that. It wasn't even addressed. And as the trial court pointed out in its order, and this was discussed earlier, such disclosure can't be too burdensome because committees have to keep track of the money in order to know when you reach that threshold. I think the addition of having to keep track of who gave the money and how much it was isn't an extensive extra burden that justified this loophole. I think that even if the secretary were bound by the 10th Circuit decision in any real way, the rule goes far beyond what would arguably be necessary to comply with that ruling. Instead of just applying, trying to craft a rule, even if you could, that would address this limited factual situation, He's created a rule that is carte blanche across the board. Every kind of committee doesn't have to meet that $200 threshold. And that is clearly beyond the scope of what Sampson did.
Well, you can see his motivation, but it puts him in the position of being the arbiter of the First Amendment.
Absolutely.
And what it means and how it's applied more generally. So do we have a separation of powers problem here? I mean, do we just have an APA problem where he's exceeded the scope of his authority, or there's standing law that he's in conflict with and the decision can't stand? Which of those? What's the standard of review?
Well, we've been operating under the APA. It's an APA review that the rule exceeded his authority because it conflicts with statutory and constitutional provisions. And so therefore it is void, and that's under the APA. But you're absolutely right. It is a There is a problem here of perhaps it's a standing issue, but we've been discussing it as APA exceeding his authority to enact rules. Now, if he's concerned about filling this gap that he perceives, he should focus on enacting procedures that are consistent with the Sampson decision and make it easier for citizens to comply with the law and reduce the burdens. Because remember, the Sampson case talked a lot about the burdens of compliance and how that was unconstitutional to apply to these particular plaintiffs. Bring up the case of FEC versus Massachusetts Citizens for Life, referred to as MCFL. That was a case that the Secretary has argued that is similar and supports his attempts to make a rule here. Now, he's half right. Sampson and MCL are somewhat similar, but there's some important distinctions. Like Sampson, the MCFL case involved an as-applied ruling that the broad prohibition in federal statutes corporate spending and express advocacy was unconstitutional as applied to certain corporations. Now, the case did not invalidate the entire statute, just like here. Instead, the Supreme Court carved out very specific circumstances under which the statute could not be applied. It did create a test, and it drew a line. Unlike here, the court did not, not the agency, the FEC. Later, the FEC enacted a rule that codify that factors that were the standard that was articulated by the Supreme Court there. In contrast here, the Secretary took it upon himself to do his own line drawing where the Sixth Circuit refused to do so. And this underscores that it's the court's role to interpret the Constitution, not the executive branch. I also want to point out another thing to think about in terms of you know, if Sampson is an as-applied ruling, as we've discussed, and I don't think there's any real dispute that it was intended to be an as-applied ruling because the court didn't go through the facial challenge test. It did not require the plaintiffs to meet the higher standard of a facial challenge, which would require a proof that all applications of the provision are unconstitutional. The reasonable doubt court did not do that, did not go through that analysis. So given that it is an as-applied ruling, where does that leave everybody? And that's really the central question. So first, it's important to look at Section 14 of the Colorado Constitution of Article 28, which addresses the issue. Said that if any provision of Article 28 or the application thereof to any person or circumstance is invalid, such invalidity shall not affect other cases or applications of the article which can be given effect. So because Sampson potentially invalidated only the application of this section to small business citizens who later spend minimum amounts in local elections, the factual situation there, other applications of that threshold remain valid, and the decision provides persuasive authority in regard to future applications of the law in similar factual contexts. And
Council, can I just ask you, I mean, if the secretary had set the limit at $2,000, would you would oppose that as well?
I think yes. It's not clear whether at what point a challenge might have been made, at what level they might have set it. That's for a different day. But potentially, yes, that could be a problem.
Okay, so I guess I'm wondering, and you use the word de minimis, and I guess it's not, from your standpoint, it's not where the level was set. It's that the secretary can't define de minimis?
The secretary can't draw the line at where that is, because it's not just a how much do you spend question. It's a what's the nature of the issue? What's the nature of the ballot initiative? Is it a really small localized thing? Is it a big statewide issue? You know, involving potentially the expenditure of millions of dollars. So that's the problem.
Okay, thank you.
So let me just ask, what do you perceive to be the parade of horribles if we went in the other direction? But what potential mischief does this lead to if we say that this is within the scope of his ability to enforce and administer the 5,000?
Well, the concern that we have is that would provide, would give the secretary the ability to then just by rule change all kinds of provisions in the statute based on his interpretation of case law. Specific examples. You know, I think that there are interpretations of case law that, in particular, the Secretary of State has espoused that Buckley versus Vallejo means certain things. I don't have the details in my head right now, but he could essentially then go into rulemaking and say, I think Buckley versus Vallejo means this, and so therefore I'm making a rule that changes how political committees are dealt with, or changes the regulation of candidate committees, because this is, you know, I have this interpretation of this particular case.
So you're suggesting the secretary could not take into account U.S. Supreme Court case law or its interpretation of U.S. Supreme Court case law when it's promulgating rules?
I don't mean to suggest that. And what I mean to say is that the secretary does have to take into account the law as it stands. But he, particularly the U.S. Supreme Court, may make him a bad example. But it is not the secretary's job to interpret case law and then rewrite state statutes and state constitution.
So it's the rewriting of the state provisions that's the problem, not the interpretation of the case law.
It's applying that interpretation to change what is in our constitution, in our statutes, in a legislative way that is beyond his authority to do. That's the authority of the legislative branch and the people if they choose to do a ballot initiative.
Council, you suggested that perhaps the secretary properly, in light of Sampson, could have promulgated rules to ease the burden of reporting or something along those lines. What exactly do you have in mind? What would that look like? I mean, it's just as you said, he can't rewrite, you know, this is what needs to be reported, name and address and employer occupation, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So what does that look like?
You know, that's a good question that probably could use some further analysis by probably greater minds than mine, but I do think that there are things that the secretary can do around the edges about making things easier online or providing forms, or there's all kinds of things around the edges that the secretary can do to ease the burdens of the citizens and make it easier for them to comply with the laws and know what it is they have to do. Some of that has been done by the General Assembly, as I mentioned earlier, but certainly there could be more. But what he can't do, what we've been talking about today, and what I want to get back to, is that he cannot unilaterally take it upon himself to promulgate a rule that contradicts clear constitutional language that has not been struck down as facially unconstitutional. And we believe that this rule exceeds the Secretary's authority and is therefore arbitrary, capricious, and contrary to law under the APA.
What's your comment about the this district court versus the Tenth Circuit approach to this case and the abuse that happened trying to scare citizens off and prevent them from exercising their petition rights?
Right, I do think this is the adage, bad cases make bad law, but there were abuses, and I don't think that you can divorce the underlying factual situation in this case from the Tenth Circuit's ruling. The Tenth Circuit took had all of that information before it and did look at the factual situation and did apply this to the factual situation of these particular plaintiffs. And that included the abuses of the enforcement process, that included the sort of convoluted nature of what came forward, that included that a good part of the financial burden ended up being attorney's fees because of the abuse of the enforcement process. So I think that was part of the 10th Circuit's ultimate analysis, and I don't think it's, I think it's kind of a distinction without a difference. Is there anything else? Thank you very much.
The 10th Circuit put the Secretary in a difficult position. I'll concede that. But the plaintiffs in this case want to put the Secretary into an impossible position. Plaintiffs want a case-by-case analysis for every political speaker, either through offensive or defensive litigation, and that's simply inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has said that the First Amendment guarantees to potential and actual political speakers. The bottom line is that if our statutes and other campaign finance provisions are unconstitutional, it's the Secretary's job to ensure that the political speakers are given the protections that the First Amendment guarantees to them. I think the biggest difficulty in this case, then, is determining exactly what similar context means. We all agree that this is an as-applied challenge. The only question is whether what a similar context will mean in future cases. And I've looked, and there are a lot of cases that say just that, that as-applied challenges have presidential effect in a similar context.
But yet the question here is whether this is a proper rule under the APA, and if it's contrary to law, isn't it our duty to not agree with the interpretive scope here that the Secretary has of the problem and of its power, and simply say this is contrary to Colorado law? Why can't we do that?
The question is whether the Sampson court invalidated the provision of Colorado law that sets a $200 threshold. And if that's true, then there is a gap in the law. This is exactly the same as the and or situation that came up after.
And the Secretary can fill the gap because he has authority because the legislature has enacted to do that.
The Secretary has the obligation to ensure that Colorado's campaign finance laws are administrable and enforceable. If the 10th Circuit said, and we believe they did, that the $200 threshold is not enforceable, then somebody has to step in and fill that gap. In the absence of any action taken through ballot initiative or by the legislature, it's the Secretary's obligation to ensure that potential political speakers in the state of Colorado will know whether they can stand. And that's exactly what this rule is designed for.
And if we disagree with the premise that that's in fact what the Sampson decision did, would you agree then that there is no gap that needs to be filled, such that the rule was unnecessary or void because there's no gap to be filled?
Yes, although I think that it's important to understand that it's very clear from the Sampson ruling, no matter how narrowly you interpret it, that there are some committees against which the threshold can't be enforced. If you have an annexation committee, then you know, maybe it's even limited to South Metro Denver. At least those people couldn't enforce the threshold against them. To get to Justice Ives' point earlier, I think that's an absurd interpretation, given that there were 372 votes cast in this election, and you had multiple dollars spent per elector. And when you compare that to any other election virtually, you're going to have a smaller drop in a bigger bucket in terms of the effect that those expenditures can have on the election and the public interest that's associated with them.
So you said that in the absence of other action by ballot initiative for the legislature, so that seems to contemplate that the Secretary is obligated to wait for some period of time before exercising any gap-filling discretion. What becomes the appropriate period of time?
In this case, the Secretary, the timing of this case was that the opinion was issued the day after the election in 2010. There were Tabor initiatives, 60, 61, and 101 were on the ballot already. For the 2011 election, it would be great if you could actually draw a line like that. But given that there was not a period in which issue committees were going to have to report, Secretary had to take immediate action. Now, Secretary Busher suspended the rulemaking process when it looked like there was going to be a legislative fix, that was entirely appropriate. But I think that in the absence of some indication that, you know, a ballot initiative is going to go on, it's incumbent on the secretary to provide clarity to speakers about whether they're going to be subject to the regulation or not.
Thank you, Mr. Grove.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Grove and also Ms. Hunt for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted and the court will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.